part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I hope I'm in the right place.
You are in the right place. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, we should just get started. And, you know, I'll just say that this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. I have a very special guest on the line. Lila Sturges is how I pronounce the name, correct? I got it right on the first try. I am a bit famous or infamous for mispronouncing last names. but thank you for joining me. And
my pleasure.
I really appreciate you jumping on. I mean, you have worked on several projects, one of which is special to my family, Lumberjanes. My daughter loves Lumberjanes. That is, and you are an Eisner nominated, correct? Writer?
That is correct.
Nice.
I'm an Eisner nominated. I got nominated for the very first book I ever worked on and never since.
Oh, really? Well, maybe hopefully this one will get you another nomination, but like,
hey,
that's
great.
A great way to start though. Like, that's a great way to start.
It was Jack of Fables that I wrote with Bill Willingham, obviously. And he, when the nomination came out, the first thing he said to me was, don't think that this is going to happen every single time.
Well, you know, hopefully that oversight will be corrected with this book because, I really enjoyed it. We should say that the book is, you are here because you are promoting, it's out, correct? It's currently
it is
out.
It is now out.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. When we originally scheduled this interview, I mean, we had to reschedule because you weren't feeling well, but it had not come out yet. So I was like, oh, and these days, so many things, like I get so much talent on this podcast that it was like supposed to come out in June, but maybe it'll come out in September. At least we know. And the book is called The Science of Ghosts. Correct?
It sure is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
It is out by Legendary Comics.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I got all my facts straight. Correct?
So far, you're like 5 for 5. Or
great. Great. I guarantee you that will not remain the case probably as we go through this discussion. I am very lucky. But thank you so much for joining me. I was privileged to read an advanced copy of the book. And I have to say that I really, really, really enjoyed it, especially being a fan of like old horror movies or ghost movies, like The Haunting or The Innocents and stuff like that. So this was right up my alley. Would you like to let people know what The Science of Ghosts is about for anybody who does not know?
Absolutely. The Science of Ghosts is a story about a woman named Joy Ravenna, who is a forensic parapsychologist, which means that she is an academic who studies ghost behavior. And she is trying to solve a murder that has become very personal to her, for reasons that I don't want to spoil. But
sure.
While all that is happening, she is also dealing with her relationship with her current partner, Kat, and her very unpleasant relationship with her previous spouse, Ronnie, who Joy is a transgender woman, and she transitioned at some point in the fairly recent past, it seems like, while she was married to this woman, Ronnie, and that did not end well. And so we're kind of seeing some of the fallout from that relationship. And we're seeing how Joy handles her newer relationships. And there's a lot going on with Joy, but she is primarily interested in solving this murder, maybe not for entirely altruistic reasons. Like, she also has some funding issues with her research that she's trying to deal with. She's got a lot going on.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's one of the things that I really loved about this book is that the lead character is a very multidimensional, sort of layered character that is interested in kind of like solving this murder mystery, but also has their own sort of reasons for doing it. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I mean, that's one of the things where it's like, usually it's completely altruistic, right? It's like, I'm a detective, right? Or I'm a, but in this case, not saying that they're not, but saying that there are other motives involved. Can you speak to that at all?
Absolutely. Joy is a very ambitious person and she wants to succeed in her field. She wants to legitimize the entire field of forensic parapsychology, which she feels is not really seen as legitimate in like the psychology world. And she has funding, you know, she has a grant to do her research with, and that grant is in danger of being yoinked because she hasn't gotten the results that she's looking for.
Yeah.
And this is not really spoilers. This is like the very beginning of the story. We learn all this.
Yeah.
So she has kind of an ulterior motive for doing the things that she's doing, and she kind of gets called out on it. And it's not entirely pretty when that happens. So I wanted her to be like a more complicated character. I wanted to have a trans character who was like multidimensional and who, you know, there were parts of her that kind of suck and, you know, parts of her that are really awesome and just like any other person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And that plays through the whole thing. I mean, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about it, was that this was not just some like, hey, like Scooby-Doo. I mean, nothing against Scooby-Doo people. I love Scooby-Doo. Don't, you know, or like, Scooby-Doo. You know, Sherlock Holmes, whatever. It's like, I'm a detective. There are multi kind of like motives, multifaceted motives involved in solving this mystery and what the main character will get out of it. And it's one of the things that I was like, oh, very cool. Like, it's not just like somebody like out to solve mysteries. So that was something that I really loved about it. The other thing that I really loved about your book, besides the writing, is the breathtaking black and white artwork. I mean, I just, when I just opened up the first page, I was just like, wow. So, I mean, I want to give a shout out to your artist. Is it L. Gehring? Did I get that correct?
You absolutely did. It's Al Gehring. He's phenomenal, and he's phenomenal for a couple of reasons. Firstly, he did an amazing job on the book, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's gorgeous to look at. It has this very distinct noir feel to it. He really kind of nailed the atmosphere. There's some pages where it's just like, it's so foreboding and mysterious, you know, and you're just like, oh my God. And he renders the characters so well. That the only issue I had with him is that he would like always like his characters had a little tendency to overact sometimes, and I would have to like rein him in a little bit. And,
oh, interesting.
And someone would be gasping, and I'd be like, no, oh, that was just a joke. Like they're not really, you know, stuff like that. But no, he did a phenomenal job. So that's one amazing thing about him. The other amazing thing about him is that he drew that entire book in someone else's style, because the book was originally meant to be drawn by Aletha Martinez, who's someone I'm a huge, huge fan of and was very excited to get. And we were very, very, very sad when she had to drop out of the project, I think for health reasons, after doing about like 40 pages or so.
Uh-huh.
And it was a real drag, because at that point, it was very hard to just say, okay, let's scrap all this and start over with a new artist.
Sure.
So we're trying to figure out what to do. And then they approached Al Gehring, and he was like, oh, I can do it. Just let me take it on and I'll fix it.
Oh.
And we were like, okay, how are you going to do that? And he's like, watch. And so he just was able to perfectly marry his style to hers. And now if I look at the book, I cannot tell you where her pages leave off and his start. Like, I literally can't do it. So that is an incredible testament to his talent and just craftsmanship, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That he was able to do that and like bring his own flair to it, you know, in other ways. So I don't know, I'm super impressed by him and I want to work with him again.
Yeah, I mean, I was super impressed because again, some of my favorite movies, I'm a big fan of old film, like and particularly like old, like kind of like noirish horror stuff. And one of my favorite movies of all time is the original Haunting. Like, I absolutely love that movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
it's
it is
wonderful.
And when I opened it up, it reminded me of that sort of thing where I was just like, oh, this isn't just like, I mean, not to degrade like black and white artwork a bit, but so many people are used to seeing stuff in color or want stuff in color. And when I opened mm-hmm. this up, it was very textured. It was very sort of like nuanced. And it reminded me very much of like these old, like kind of like spooky horror movies that I would see like maybe on Turner Classic Movies and that sort of thing. Is that something that you were looking for when you were kind of creating this, that sort of look?
It is, although I don't know that it was as well thought through as that. I think it was more like a vibe that I was kind of shooting for.
Okay.
And in the back of my head, I always have like Jean Cocteau, like I'm a real Cocteau fan.
Got it.
And especially the 1946 Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Which I think is like this perfect film. And
gorgeous.
And so I think that's always like sitting in the back of my mind. Films like that, films like The Big Sleep, like 1940s noir cinema is something that I really, really appreciate. And I think I might have been writing towards that, although it wasn't like a conscious thing that I was like setting out to do. And okay. we decided to do the book in black and white just after a very brief conversation. My editor, Jan Jones, was like, you know, I was thinking, what if we did this in black and white? And I was like, yes. And I think that was like the entire conversation.
So you had no reaction to that, like, because I mean, obviously something like The Walking Dead has maybe changed the sort of like mm-hmm. avoidance that people want to have towards black and white books. But so you had no like knee jerk reaction to being like, no, it needs to be in color. Because that I know that sometimes people are like, oh, well, I like my stuff to be in color. But I mean, I personally love black and white. So you were just like, let's go with it.
I did. And, you know, it's funny. It wasn't until I was talking to a friend of mine. It was my buddy, Dave Justice, who was like, oh, you know, I'm surprised it's in black and white. He hadn't seen it before. Like, I'm surprised it's in black and white that's kind of daring of you. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's just what seemed right for the story. And I didn't really think too hard about like the marketing implications of that or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because if you start thinking about that stuff during the creative process, you're just, can I say swear words on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Do it.
You're totally fucked. If you, nice. You know, if you start thinking about that stuff too much. So I try to just put it all out of my head and just think like, what's the best thing for this story? What's the best thing for this particular project? And then when the book comes out, I can freak out about all those considerations.
Got it.
Like,
got it.
And like pray that people buy it, you know,
Got it. And was there any concern on the artist part? Like, oh, we're doing this in black and white, or that's something that they knew when they were going in?
He was all for it.
Nice.
He was absolutely stoked to do it that way. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. I mean, another aspect of the art, and I don't want to focus on that too much, but it is the sort of thing that, you know, I'm a creative, like artistic person in my own, you know, life. And I, mm-hmm. That's why I got into comics was the art. But one of the things that I really love too is that the style reminded me a bit of like the old sort of like Modesty Blaze strips or like the James Bond stuff that I've come across like in like Titan mm-hmm. books or like reprints. Was there any sort of, was that an aspect of the look of the book that you were thinking that you might want to go into? Because there is, you know, obviously, you know, there's Image style and then there's Marvel style. And then there is this very sort of like classic older kind of like look to comic art that is very elegant, but doesn't really sort of get used a lot today, or at least that I've been able to see in modern comics. Any thoughts to that? Or is that something you were going for at all? Or is that just something that kind of sprung up in the creative process?
That's a really good point. You know, I hadn't really thought about like Modesty Blaze is a really great touchstone for that. Uh-huh. The kind of what's the word I'm looking for? The art has a certain kind of severity to it. Maybe that's the word. Maybe a little more chiaroscuro.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it has this really kind of classy, timeless look to it.
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
And I really respond to that a lot. Again, like that's all Al doing that.
Got it. Okay.
That's just him interpreting the script and probably pulling on those exact references, you know, for all we know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I was just wondering because obviously you are the sort of creator of the piece as the writer. I mean, my assumption is that this was initially your idea and you wrote it and you maybe went to a publisher. I'm always surprised by the ins and outs of publishers because there are some publishers who are like, we have an idea. Would you like to write it for us? And I'm like, oh, I thought this was your original. Right. But my assumption was that this is your original sort of concept. And whether that was like a sort of thing you went to it with, which was like, oh, I want this to be like, because, you know, sometimes people visualize and they want it to look a certain way. And you're saying that's just something that sprung in the creative, like as it went on.
Absolutely. I think when I am imagining like how my script is going to be drawn, I don't put anything in the script to that effect. What I do is I try to very carefully select the artist that I'm going to work with. And in this case, I had an artist in mind and got to work with that artist for, like I said, 30 pages.
Yeah.
And then she had to leave the book. But I think that imprint was left on the book. And so because I am not the most visual person, honestly, in the world, it's like I know what I like, but I'm not always the best at describing that.
Sure.
So like I can tell you like, oh, you know, I love the art of Jim Steranko, but like if I tried to tell you why, I would very easily devolve into just ape noises, you know?
but I know
what I like. And so, this is something that I think may surprise some readers is that, you know, when I write a comic book script, I am not telling the artist how to draw it.
Okay.
You know, like I am telling them what needs to be present in order for the story to be conveyed, but everything else I leave up to them because I think they're going to be a better judge than me of how to execute stuff. You know, like that's their job. That's what they're good at. And if an artist ever came back to me and said, hey, I need more, I would happily give them more. And that has happened a couple of times. You know, I had one artist who was very, very talented. I won't say who it is. He's an exceptionally talented artist. Maybe one of the best people working in comics these days. This was a long time ago, but he was so insecure that he was afraid to follow the script that I had given him. So I gave him a ton more stuff in the panel description so that he could feel more comfortable. But that's usually not the case. Usually I just tell an artist like, here's the script, run with it, do whatever you need to do, have a blast. And they do that. So.
Oh, got it. So, I mean, let's dive into that just a little bit because like, what's your process? Mm-hmm. Because I know that for many people, it's very much like DC style, Marvel style, like, you know, and then you've got Alan Moore, who is like, literally like there's a fly on the table, on the clock and the clock says 3 o'clock and the second hand is here. Like, you know what I mean? How are you breaking down sort of like your scripts? Do you do sort of like a like concept first, like a treatment, and then do you break it down into pages? Is it panel by panel? You know, Stan Lee style? Like how does your script writing process work?
Well, I have a process that I have developed over the almost 20 years that I've been doing this that works really well for me. And I think it's important to say that it works really well for me and it may not work well for someone else, but it's worth trying because I think it's a pretty good system. So you know, usually, you know, it starts with a pitch, which is anywhere from like a page to 4 pages or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so I will have the basic idea of the story and the characters down. If the pitch gets approved, then I'll go to an outlining stage where I will break the entire thing down into like individual issues if it's like a mini series or just like a page count if it's a graphic novel. And I actually make a spreadsheet that shows for every scene that I imagine in the story how many pages I think that scene will take. And then I can just sum that up and make sure that it equals the right number of pages for the book, right? Because for a graphic novel, it depends, you know, you'll get a range of how many pages you can do. Mm. And sometimes like with the Lumberjanes books, they're like, this has to be 110 pages, period. No more, no fewer. So sometimes you have goals that you have to write towards. And so this outlining process comes in really, really handy because then as I'm writing the book, I can kind of check back and forth with this outline and see is, are my page counts for the, for each scene actually matching? Then when I go to write an individual scene, I know what needs to happen in that scene. And so I typically start with dialogue. I just start writing the dialogue, but really what I'm looking for is pacing when I'm writing out a scene like that. It's like, I want to know how is the scene going to flow? And a lot of that is how much dialogue is going in, where there is no dialogue, how many panels on a given page, all that stuff, all that like nuts and bolts stuff. That's a lot of what I'm thinking in my brain as I'm doing this. And then I'll generally zip back in and fill out the panel descriptions. And that, for writing panel descriptions, I always try to give the artist just enough information. I think it was, oh gosh, who was it? Who said that they're a comic book artist, and she said, you know, all I really need is an action and an emotion. No, that's what a comic book panel ideally is. One action, one emotion. And that has always stuck with me as a very wise, like, rule of thumb to follow.
Oh,
and
wow.
Not always the case. You know, sometimes you're doing stuff, you know, you want something where there's a lot of stuff going on or whatever, but for your average, you know, day to day, your bread and butter five panel page, it's a really good thing to keep in mind.
Wow. Wow. And so am I understanding this correctly that you're sort of like breaking everything down by pages, and then you're sort of like figuring out how many panels go on a page, and then you mm-hmm. are writing to those panels. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm typically like breaking down the panels around the dialogue.
Okay.
Because I'll try to fit the dialogue in if it's, you know, if there's like a conversation happening, obviously if it's like a wordless scene or something, that's a different approach, but fitting in each individual action, reaction, you know, emotional state, every panel has to have a separate emotional state in it, because you can't change emotions over the course of a single panel. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm breaking out that, I'm breaking out the emotional moments of the scene and the accompanying dialogue, and then everything else fits that.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And as a writer, I mean, imagine this sounds like a very disciplined way of sort of writing a script or writing things down. Is there something that it seems like you might have to resist the temptation to overwrite, like in panels, to get the result that you want. Am I correct in that, or am I incorrect?
No, you're completely right. And the biggest issue always for me with writing a comic book script is that I'm always tempted to add more than will fit. And so there's a trimming process, but that pruning process usually is only to the good, because it makes you really examine what's there and see like what can I live without, you know. Gotcha. And the tighter a script is, usually the better it is.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, let's talk about the science of goats a little more, because I mean, that's kind of like why you're here. But I mean, I'm assuming
I'm happy to talk about craft all day long.
But well, you know, that is, I mean, it's not a criticism of this podcast, but sometimes, you know, in the beginning of the show, I will get a little bit, because that's kind of like what I'm curious about sometimes is like with interviews, is like knowing how people work or like where they came from or what they're about. And we get a little lost in those details, and it's like, oh, wait, we got to talk about the book. So, I mean, I want people to go check out this book, The Science of Ghosts, again, by Legendary Comics, and which I very much enjoyed. I'm assuming that you are a big fan of mystery, like mystery novels or ghost stories, stuff like that.
That's a very safe assumption. I mean, I'm drawing from things that I love. And when I put the story together, it was, you know, I have one idea generating tool that I use, which is, I just call it smushing, where you take like your favorite things and you smush them together and see if there's a story there.
Yeah.
So I think for this, it was kind of like a combination of, you know, a fairly straightforward detective story, plus a kind of a creepy ghost story. And then plus the secret ingredient, the ingredient X or whatever for this story is, when I was growing up, It was, you know, the '70s, and I was very young. I was not, you know, an adult or anything in the '70s. Please sure. don't think that. But
same here.
There was all this interest in like the occult and like ESP.
Yeah, in search like of
ghosts and yeah, In Search Of was my favorite.
Yeah,
show.
Oh, yeah, it scared the crap out of me.
I've been talking about In Search Of all day long. I've been talking about In Search Of in like every podcast interview that I do.
And, there and you most go. People have.
And you're the first person I've talked to that's ever heard of it. So this is really great. Like Leonard Nimoy out yep. there just telling you the truth about spontaneous human combustion. It was like my favorite thing
yeah.
ever.
Yeah. Scared the shit out of me as a kid, honestly, a lot of times.
And so I wanted to bring that vibe into it. And so to me, like making her a scientist was really important because that brings to me that vibe of like, you know, we're doing science about the supernatural. Like, to me, that is just like, you can't go wrong. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, The Orphanage.
No, I don't think so.
It's a Cuarón film. It's Spanish. It's like this, like, it's a haunted house story. Very well done. Very spooky, very scary. One of my favorite parts, though, is at one point, like, the mom who's being haunted in this house brings in like these ghost researchers and they have all their like equipment and oscilloscopes and stuff. It's like, that is my jam right there. Like you can't do better than that, in my opinion.
Are you a fan of those shows like Ghost Hunters and stuff like that? Like, is that something that you check out or?
I, you know, here's the thing about the ghost hunting shows that they're unserious.
Got
you
it.
Know, they are, they're entertainers. They are not people of science. That's yeah. what bugs me about it.
Well, for yeah. me, it's always the thing. I'm very much like, I've said this before on the podcast, I am very much Scully, not Mulder. Despite all the comics and all the stuff that I'm into, like I love sci-fi, I love, but unless I see it with my eyes, I'm like, it doesn't, it's not that it doesn't exist. I'm also a big believer in that the universe is a big and varied place, but I'm very skeptical. I'm like, come on, Mulder, really? You saw aliens? Like, I don't, like, yeah. So I am very skeptical about stuff like that. But my thing with those ghost hunter shows is very much like, really? Like, you just happened to catch it? Like, you happened to be there? Like, when I was like, yeah, I don't mm-hmm. buy it. Like, I'm just like, no. Like, you know,
I'm with you, but was it Kierkegaard or Captain Kirk who said, I like to believe that there are always possibilities.
Sure.
You know,
sure. I just have a hard time believing that you caught them on camera just when your film crew yeah. was like, happened to be like, you know what I mean? If it's so hidden and not everyone has seen it, there just happened to be this TV yes. show production company that came across. Anyway, I haven't watched enough of them, so maybe I'm being prejudiced. So I apologize.
Well, there's one really good one that I've seen, and I can't remember the name of it, but like what the best part is that they have this guy who comes in and like explains why these people think they're seeing a ghost.
Oh,
you know, and it's like, I you know, examined the house and I found out there was like this faulty circuit breaker, you know, and that was making the lights flicker, you know, and I found this thing and that's what was making that creepy noise.
Yeah.
And then that's like the second act of the show. And then the third act, the like ghost researchers come back and they're like, well, that's an interesting hypothesis, but probably it was ghosts, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. I got to find that. If you remember the name of that, please email it to me.
I will tell you if I remember.
Let me know later on. But another great aspect of this is the lead character's, you know, identity, right? Like that mm-hmm. I very much yeah. enjoyed. And what I really loved about this story is that you didn't shy away from it at all. Like the main character mm-hmm. is trans. So far, I'm correct in using that term,
yes.
right? Okay, because absolutely. I'm a boring cis half Latino man. So I want to get all my pronouns and everything correct. I'm on, you know,
sure. mm-hmm.
I want to be good. So, you know, so far I've been 6 out of 6, now 7 out of 7,
yep.
hopefully. but so, I very much appreciated you, like, obviously the character is a real three-dimensional character, but I also appreciated the aspect of the story where it's their ex was involved and the uncomfortableness mm-hmm. of like what the ex went through and the
yeah.
resentment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really feel like I'm, you know, everyone be whoever they want to be, but there's a show, The Umbrella Academy, right? Where the person, the lead actor went from female to male, you know, and stuff. And they were just like, oh, that's fine. And for me, it's like, it is fine. Like, that's perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Be whatever you want to be. But the reaction to me was a little bit unrealistic in that there wasn't anyone who was like kind of pushing back. And they didn't need to fight it, but it didn't seem realistic to me. And to me, in this story, you have an ex who is still like very resentful and very like hurt and angered by it, but still will go out of their way for that person. Can you, which is something that if you love somebody or loved, you know, in your life, you would do things for them despite whatever you've been through, right? Like, as long as it wasn't like cheating or, you know, or abuse or like that sort of thing. Can you speak to me a little bit about that? Because I love the ghost story. I love everything about it. But this is an aspect of the story that I don't think we see enough in stories like this. So, can you know, just fill me in on whatever's going through your head when you kind of like address this aspect of the story.
Absolutely. Thanks. It's something I spent a lot of time thinking. Probably the thing I spent the most time thinking about was that relationship between those two people.
Oh, interesting.
And how I wanted, and how I wanted to portray it.
Yeah.
Nothing else gave me as much of a, as much difficulty as making that the way I wanted it. Does that make sense? It was very challenging. And I think when you're writing a queer story, there's sort of like two main avenues that you can take. And one of them is like the Lumberjanes approach, where you set your story in a world where things like homophobia and transphobia don't really exist. Like there's no direct experience of them at all, right? And everybody's just free to be themselves. And I think that's really important because that allows us to envision a world like that, and then another avenue you can take is to set your story like in the real world that we all live in, where things like homophobia and transphobia exist. And kind of the thing that sucks about doing that is that you can genuinely trigger your queer readers by showing them things that they may have personally experienced and really, really, really hurt them, right? So in this book, I wanted this book to be clearly set in the real world, except for probably there's ghosts, right? and I wanted there to be
They're real.
I wanted there to be something really chewy about this relationship between between Joy and her ex.
Yeah.
And because of like some of my own personal experiences and experience of other trans people that I know, this is a real thing that happens, you know? And it's like, it's not fun, it's not pretty, but it's real. I think what's very interesting about those two characters is that they both have unresolved feelings for each other, and they manage those feelings in very, very different ways. Like Ronnie, the ex-wife, manages those feelings by being very angry, you know, and feeling really betrayed. And Joy manages those feelings by kind of throwing herself under the bus, you know, but she really, really wants Ronnie to still care about her in some way and is willing to kind of punish herself in order to make that happen. And neither one of those is a particularly like healthy approach. So I think that's where good storytelling happens.
Yeah.
You know, and so we can't always shy away from it, I guess, is the long answer to your question.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. And it's very much one of the things that I really kind of appreciated beyond the central sort of like ghost story and mystery and everything. I was like, huh, this is uncomfortable. Like, you know what I mean? And you don't really see.
I mean,
like,
the thing is,
oh, go ahead.
It's the Science of Ghosts is really a story about grief. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, it's about loss and how we cope with loss. And so, you know, the ghosts are metaphors, you know, and I tried very hard to have all the metaphorical aspects and the, like the thematic stuff really like go along part and parcel with the plot. So neither one feels tacked on. And I feel like this is the closest I've ever come to really succeeding at that.
Oh, that's great. I mean, yeah, honestly, it is something that I was kind of like not expecting. And I was very much like, oh, this feels real. Like, I mean, the whole package mm-hmm. of this book, for anyone who's listening, it feels very, the whole world that it exists in feels very concrete, feels very like the black and white art, like what I was talking about before, mm-hmm. the sort of like, you know, older maybe style of the art and every, and the story as well feels like really concrete to me, where I was just like, it's funny because we're talking about ghosts, but it felt like really mm-hmm. grounded. How hard did you have to work at doing that within something that is a ghost story, essentially, and a mystery?
Sure, sure, sure. It's, I mean, if you kind of look back over my career and you like kind of dig into a lot of the things that I've written, you'll see that there is this kind of a trend where I try to create really realistic environments in which totally wacky shit happens, right? That's kind of my, I think that's my stock in trade, honestly. And it's not always obvious that that's what's happening, but you know, I think the science of ghosts is just kind of like the apotheosis of that, where I tried to create a very, very lived in realistic world that felt like just like our world, and then slam the ghosts into it, because that's, I think, where horror comes from. Horror comes from what is safe, what is reliable being broken.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Being taken away from you.
Yeah.
And you no longer have that agency or the comfort that the way you thought things work actually worked that way.
Yeah.
And so you have to feel safe first. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the aspects I want to discuss about this book is the mystery, like the murder and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. I don't know how to say anything without spoiling anything. Like, really? So
yes.
I want to let you, I mean, you talked a little bit about the plot beforehand, but can you address like what happens, the central sort of murder, without spoiling it? Because I don't want to screw anything up, because I think this is a book that people should pick up.
Yeah, no, and I don't want to spoil anything, but I think things of the world I could say about it. So
yeah.
One of the things that I wanted was, I wanted it to be kind of a fair play mystery, in the sense that, like, maybe you could get evidence from a ghost, but that would be evidence in addition to all the other evidence that you would use to solve the mystery, right?
That was cool.
The ghost wouldn't just come out and tell you who done it, because that would suck.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to find some way to kind of obfuscate what the ghosts were saying. And that was, to me, a big part of the story, is having the ghosts be kind of living and speaking in this sort of dreamlike fashion, where like, it's almost like the ghosts are having a waking dream that they exist in and they can't escape, which to me is kind of frightening. And so that's part of how Joy like solves things, is by interacting with ghosts, which she is like uniquely able to do, and then doing like the academic research to try and like understand what the ghosts are actually saying, and that's her sort of like modus operandi. But there's also like real clues and like you know, fingerprints and other stuff. So there are aspects of like a more standard detective story as well. And I wanted to have both.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that I was like, oh, cool. Where it's like very much, well, there's a couple of things, right? There's the fact that ghosts can kind of be solid in a way, or interact with mm-hmm. solid things or people. Like, you don't often see that. And the fact that you can use, or that the lead character is trying to use evidence left behind by the ghosts in an actual legal kind of like murder case. Like, it's very different than anything that I've seen before. You must have given some thought to like, how much research did you do on ghosts? Because I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, or that I've thought about way too often, being a nerd and loving mm-hmm. like ghost stories and horror stories and stuff like that, is my thing about ghosts is like, I think they're just there to drive you insane. They don't interact with you. They don't fuck with you. They don't do anything. Mm-hmm. They're just there, but they're so from, they're so otherworldly, and that you can visually see them and you can hear them, that you doubt the reality of your senses. But your ghosts are a little bit different. Can you speak to that a little bit, please?
Sure. I think one thing that I wanted to do with ghosts, just to take kind of a novel approach, was that I wanted the ghosts to have kind of like a reason for being there other than just being spooky.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think there's two main functions of ghosts in a ghost story. And like, one is to scare the reader. So there's like titillating aspect. And the other is to act as a metaphor for something, you know, whether it's memory or grief or insanity or, you know, all of the things that ghosts have traditionally stood for, you know, through all the ghost stories. And I wanted to play around with the idea that the ghosts themselves could be like, could function in the service of the story in a more direct way. I guess that's what I was after.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this storytelling trick that I was trying to do. But at the same time, like, I wanted to make them oblique because I didn't want everything they did to be kind of like obvious.
Sure.
And straightforward. So that's why I gave them kind of this dreamlike existence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. it was very cool because it was very true to what I understand sort of like ghosts to be, like trapped in this nebulous state, or like the thing that everyone mm-hmm. thinks, oh, there was something unsolved or something unresolved right. at the end of their life and they're stuck behind. But in this kind of particular instance, you have sort of a spirit or something that can actually affect what happens in the real world. And it was like something that I hadn't really, I mean, you do see it maybe like in Ghostbusters, like Slimer, like runs yeah. into it. You know? But I mean, this yeah. was more sort of like it was directed, right? Like it was something that like, yeah. and could like assault a person for a reason. And it felt like, I don't know why I keep using the term concrete in the context of a ghost story, but it felt like something like that was tactile. And you don't usually see that in ghost stories.
Yeah. That tactility was important to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
I thought all that was like very cool and very unique and like very different. I guess generally speaking, how much research have you done or looked into actual parapsychology? Because your lead character is very, I mean, or either you were able to fake it really well or you did your research, because it seems like this person has a PhD and, you know, and investigate stuff. And how much research beyond episodes of In Search Of, like, did you do on parapsychology?
I mean, that's the thing. It's like my whole life has been leading up to this.
I've read
so much about this junk. I have like a whole collection of books about like paranormal stuff. Uh-huh. I have one book that's all about like parapsychology, and I can't get enough of it. I can't get enough of like people who like have an idea about the way the world works and just like lean really hard into it, despite the fact that they have no evidence for any of it.
Sure.
And I think that's really beautiful and kind of nuts. And I really love that. And that's so much of what that kind of, you know, paranormal stuff is. So I really get a kick out of reading about the paranormal and always have. So I didn't really have to do any research for the book because it was all just bubbling. It's all been bubbling away in the back of my head for freaking ever.
Is that a field that you ever thought like maybe seriously? I mean, it exists, right? Like it's a thing, right? Like
yeah.
it's legit.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, my takeaway from Ghostbusters was like, oh, you can get a job studying ESP. How do I do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I have written, you know, treatments for things that are all about like ESP. And so my great ESP story has yet to be written, but someday I will do it because.
We're talking about ESP, like mind reading and stuff like that. And
yeah. Mind reading, remote viewing, all that stuff, but like in a really sciencey way, you know?
Oh, nice. Nice. I love that stuff. I mean, you and I yeah. must be from the same generation because we're talking about In Search Of and yeah. ESP. And there was a big time like in the late 70s and early 80s where it's like that stuff was huge, right?
Yes. I mean, you had what's his name? The Israeli mentalist. Oh God, why can't I think of his name right now? who would go on, like Johnny Carson and, you know, Ben Spoons and stuff. Uri Geller.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And people were obsessed with him. You know, he was like an international celebrity.
Yeah.
So, you know, the 70s were a very, like, wonderfully credible time. Like, people would believe anything.
Yeah. There was no internet. Well, now they believe everything. That's the problem.
Now they believe everything.
Yeah.
Now they believe everything. Back then, they would believe anything.
Yeah.
That was the crucial difference.
Yeah.
It's always fascinating to me to see, like, astrology come back around, because that was so big in the 70s. And then, you know, everyone was kind of embarrassed about it through the 80s, the 90s. But then, like, in the 2010s, it's like the queer community especially is like, we are all about astrology now. And I was so surprised by that. I was like, no, we debunked this 50 years ago. What are you talking about?
Oh, really? So, like, is that, like, a big thing in the queer community, like astrology now? Or is
huge. It's huge.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, as of what, recently? Or...
as of the past 10 years or more.
And yeah. What is it that you think has taken like hold? Like, what is that? Like, where do you think that comes from?
Oh, I think it's really clear where it comes from. I think that we live in a very turbulent universe that does not care about us at all.
Okay.
And life is full of events, and our brains really, really want to make sense of those events.
Got it.
Because we are pattern seeking creatures, man. That is, like, what we are absolutely best at,
uh-huh,
is discovering patterns and things. Uh-huh. And so I think if someone comes along and says, hey, I've got this system that has, like, this explanatory power, and it's, like, fun, and it, like, tells you a little bit about yourself, and it helps you understand the people around you, and it doesn't just help you, like, see things a certain way. It gives you a common language for discussing certain things. So, like, if someone says, oh, I am such a Scorpio, like, that means something.
Sure.
You know, like, that means something to people that they can take away and go, oh, well, that's a very emotionally intense person.
Got
it. You know,
it.
And so it gives you this shorthand for, like, you know, there's all sorts of ways around, you know, like, I happen to be a very stereotypical Libra.
Yeah.
Just as it so happens.
Yeah.
But if I were actually a Capricorn or whatever, then I could say, oh, well, yeah, I'm a Capricorn, but I've got, like, a Libra rising, you know? And, like, all of this, like, it gets very complicated. And so you can find really any answer you want. And now that I'm saying this, like, all the queer listeners of your podcast are going to be like, traitor!
Oh, jeez. Well, I'm a very stereotypical Leo, apparently. So, yeah, that's just...
okay, well, there you go.
It's another thing that I'm super skeptical about, though. Like,
when
Scully comes out in me, like, really, Christian? Yeah, so I don't... one of the things I wanted to ask you, were just talking about ESP. One of my favorite, mm-hmm, sort of movies from that era is The Fury. Like, have you ever seen that De Palma movie with Kirk Douglas and the telekinetics, and it's kind of gory a little bit. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never heard of it.
You've never heard of The Fury? Oh, well, first of all, we did an episode of the podcast about it. So anyone, mm-hmm, who loves The Fury should check that out. But yeah, The Fury is a long kind of forgotten De Palma movie with Kirk Douglas.
Okay.
And Amy Irving, I believe. And it is all about, like, you know, psychic powers and telekinesis,
yeah,
and, like, all that stuff. So if you're a fan of that, if you're a fan of that kind of stuff, you may like it, but there's a lot of gore,
okay,
and it's a little silly at times. It's
sure.
Not De Palma's best, but, like, you know,
okay.
I love it. I love it. Sorry.
Did you ever see Stir of Echoes?
Not for a while. It's been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. And it touches on some of that stuff.
I'm going to have to rewatch that. Oh, that's
great. But it's the film doesn't do a deep dive into it. It just kind of, like, touches on it.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty cool.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that just popped into my head while you were talking earlier, sort of about, like, storytelling things and, like, trans narratives and things like that. Were you a fan of Pose, mm-hmm, like that show on FX at all? Like, did you watch that at all? I was just curious because Pose.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Did you? I'm sorry. Did you watch it? I didn't hear you.
I did. Yeah, I watched every episode and loved it. I thought it was It's a fantastic chronicle of a very specific community in a very specific place and time.
Yeah.
And it owes a lot of its existence to a film called Paris is Burning, which I don't know if you've ever seen.
Yeah.
It can be a very difficult film to watch, especially if you're trans. And I think they took that and expanded on it, and they got people who like were there at the time to write for it and stuff. So I thought it was really brilliant. It's kind of a strange thing because when I watch that show, I can't relate to a lot of it.
Okay.
You know? But then other parts of it, I absolutely, completely, utterly relate to. So it's weird. It's a very, very different place and time to be a trans woman, you know, in 1980s New York.
Oh, I'm sure.
Than it is to be, and a trans woman of color, you know?
Yeah.
So for me being like a white trans woman in 2024, very different experience, right?
Yeah.
But we still have a lot in common. And so it gave me a lot to think about. And I thought it was wonderful.
Understood. I mean, the only reason that I bring it up is because it is a show that I loved as well. And I kind of grew up in that area in New York, kind of like when all that, but I was young,
okay. You
know, I was very young. And the thing that I loved about it starts off like kind of like very gritty, and like the characters are like, it's like a bad place for a lot of them. And obviously they're surrounded by the seedy New York. And for me, what was great about it is that it kind of grew into this. And as weird as it is to say, because, you know, it occurred during the AIDS pandemic and all that, you know, stuff in the 80s. But it seemed to be like a show that worked to give its characters the happy ending that like straight kind of like cis characters got. Like it gave them the things that, like, you know what I mean? Because it starts off in one place and it's like, oh, it's very seedy and dark. And it's like, oh, is this all they have, you know, to look forward to in life? And then as it went on, it transformed into something else. And I was like, how fucking great is this? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I just thought it was cool. So.
No, I think it's really cool. And I think that is maybe also partially like a response to Paris is Burning again, you know, or the actual circumstances surrounding Paris is Burning, you know, the whole ballroom culture with, you know, that film ends on an extremely bleak note.
Yeah.
You know, you learn that one of the people you've been seeing in this documentary the whole time has been murdered for being a trans woman, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like so fucking dark. And so it's nice to have like a different picture of that.
Yeah.
You know, that isn't just like unspeakably bleak and dark, because our lives as trans people are not just that. And that's one of the big things I wanted to do with Science of Ghosts, to show that like, as trans people, we have lives and we love and we have jobs and we do stuff, and our whole lives don't just focus around being transgender. Like that's a part of my life, but it's just a part, and it's not the biggest part even.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's why it just popped in my head with what you were discussing about how, you know, different stories treat trans people kind of like in different ways, and you know, none of them are necessarily wrong, but like that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about this book too, is that, and a lot of, you know, trans narratives that I've read, you know, in the past that I've been exposed to, which is like, these are people, they're very concrete people, and there's complex issues that you have to deal with and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, they're going through their lives and they're trying to solve their things. And, you know, that's no different than anybody else, like, you know what I'm saying? And I love stuff like this that kind of like, you know, it's normal, like, you know what I mean? So, so in any case, as you were talking about that show Pose kind of popped in my head, and I remember especially in the final episodes, like just like really just being like, oh, that was great, like, you know what I mean? And it's kind of obviously it's not the same feeling that I'm getting from your book, which is, you know, very different, but in its own way it kind of gave me that experience where it was like, oh, this is a very like, I keep saying concrete. I need to think of other adjectives, but concrete story that's set in reality that has ghosts in it. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and I hope this isn't a spoiler, and I know I've almost had you on for an hour, so I don't want to keep you any longer than you need to be kept.
That's
but
fine.
There is a thing that happens at the end, and I don't know. Can you speak to that? I don't want to spoil it. I don't even want to say what it involves unless you do, but I found it to be very powerful at the ending, and I was like, wow. It was just like the sort of like nail that kind of like sealed the story shut for me, and I was like, right on. Like it was a great way to end it for me. I don't know, it spoke to me. Like I felt like I was moved by it. Can you, I don't want to say what it is unless you do, but like can you speak to that?
Are you talking about the very 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 end, like the last few pages of the book?
I'm talking about the medium in the courtroom and the scene with the other person. I don't want to say what it is because unless you want to say what it is.
I don't want to say, and I don't want to spoil it, but I will say that the book ends in a very non-traditional way in that there is a character who sort of appears out of nowhere and sort of recontextualizes some things about our protagonist.
Yeah.
In a way that I think it's intended to do two things. It's first to kind of leave you on kind of a uncertain note. It's like, yes, things wrapped up well, didn't they? Like, that's how I want you to kind of walk away from the story.
Yeah.
And then also to suggest that maybe there's more stories coming that will delve into this matter further. I mean, that's kind of the hope.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I felt it was very kind of like traditional kind of like ghost story, like leaving you off with like, oh wait, what's going on here? There's something different happening.
Yeah.
But it was also just like a really great way to wrap up like what was going on and something that I hadn't seen early on in the story. And I just loved it, Lila. I thought it was great. Like that was one thing that I wanted to leave you with, if anything, at the end of this interview was how much I enjoyed like the whole book, but the end I was like, 10. You landed on a 10. Like it was like stand up with the gymnast pose and like, you know what I mean? Taking the accolades. So thank you so much.
There is something, sure. And there is something very interesting about that character, which I will not spoil.
Yeah.
But if you were to reread the book, you might notice something else.
Okay. Okay. Maybe I'll have to go. Yeah. I went back. I mean, I read it originally when we, you know, were originally scheduled to read the interview. And then this morning I was quickly doing like a quick reread and like, okay, like, did I miss anything?
Like, what was about this book about?
Yeah, yeah. No, I remembered it, but I was just like, okay, I got to go back. So Lila Sturges, any sort of final thoughts on the science of ghosts or anything else you want to let people know about? Like, where can they find you online? That sort of thing.
Sure. I really hope people will pick up The Science of Ghosts. You know, I would love for it to be like the little book that could.
Yeah.
Because it's not a superhero book, because it doesn't have like, you know, an enormous amount of name recognition or any of that stuff. Like, you know, books like these are sometimes a hard sell. And so I would just love it if people would give it a chance. I can be found in a couple of different places. Probably the most straightforward way to find me is on Instagram at Lila K. Sturges. And my website, lilasturges.com. I'm not really doing any other social medias at the moment.
Good for you.
The social media landscape is kind of, ooh.
Yeah, it's lost its mind. I hate it.
It's lost its mind. It's not really for me at this point. So I'm kind of hiding away from it at the moment. But, you know, if you Google me, you can find all kinds of stuff. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to say that I love The Science of Ghosts. And I thank you so much for taking the time to come onto my podcast. You're welcome back anytime.
Pleasure. It was.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, I was just going to say I've done a lot of interviews for this book so far, and this has been one of the most enjoyable.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope you really mean that. I hope you're not just.
I do. I absolutely do. I have not said that to other people. I promise.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Oh, are you going to be at San Diego Comic-Con at all, or do you have any appearances lined up or anything?
I don't think I'm doing any cons this year. I will be doing signings of Science of Ghosts. I actually have one in a couple of hours that I need to get to.
Oh, nice.
But Yeah, as far as like con appearances, I don't really have anything this year. I'm hoping to like come out roaring in 2025 with a bunch of stuff.
Well, awesome. I mean, even if you're not there, like I it's just the season. So I have to ask everyone, are you going to be at San Diego? But yeah. Thank you for coming on to the podcast. I just really appreciate your time. And I'm glad you're feeling better since the last time. And again, the book is called The Science of Ghosts. And it is out by Legendary Comics right now. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out at parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. We are no longer on the hellscape that is Twix. I have a little hobby comic called The Periwinkle Puss. You can check that out at theperiwinklepuss.com. It's just a hobby. But in the meantime, go to your local comic book shop, bookstore, find The Science of Ghosts. I guarantee you it's worth checking out. I loved it. I love old movies like The Haunting and The Innocents. And if you like that sort of stuff, if you like Nancy Drew, whatever, The Science of Ghosts is for you. I thought it was great. Thank you, Lila, for your time. And thank you for listening. We will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time. Part-time fanboy.com.